There's a time and a place for a fillet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything, to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're tuned in to our 4th of July 2025 flashback weekend, a look back at some of the biggest stories we've been covering for you so far in 2025. What you're about to hear is a previous broadcast.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
It took 5 years to find the so-called killer of Abby Williams and Libby German. 5 years. It's a long amount of time when you're trying to figure out who the perpetrator is in a small town of killing two of your youngest. 5 years of silence, speculation, and frustration. And yet, when Richard Allen was arrested in 2022, it felt less like a breakthrough and more like a plot twist nobody saw coming. Not because Allen was some criminal mastermind who evaded justice, but because the case against him, when you actually look at it, barely exists. It is what it is. But here we are, a 50-year-old CVS worker from Delphi, Indiana, convicted of a crime so horrific it shattered an entire community, sentenced to 130 years. In prison for the brutal murders of two young girls. And the families of those girls, they believe they have their answer. They believe Richard Allen is the monster who took their daughters. Maybe for them, that's enough. I'm not going to profess to know what it feels like to be in that situation. I hope to God I'm never, ever, ever in that situation. And I have a ton of empathy and sympathy for those families. I can't imagine how you process something like that. And if coming to a conclusion and hoping that the people you entrusted your faith in to find this killer results in justice, or you believe resulted in justice, I get it. You can't keep reliving this nightmare over and over in your mind every single day, even though I'm sure you do. The thing is about this case is justice doesn't have opinions about feelings. It doesn't have opinions about the damage that it has done to a family, to a community, to parents, to sisters, to brothers, to aunts and uncles, to everybody who is missing two little girls that should still be on this planet. And just because the people you trust or trusted to put their killer behind bars bring you someone and say, "This is the guy," it does not mean they are right. You want to believe it's right. You hope to God they are right. Because why would you want to go through hell and back and a trial only to find out, oh my God, there's a ton of evidence that really It points to other people. It does not point to this guy that they told us was the man. And what they do have is flimsy at best. So I'm not here to try and change anybody's opinion who is a family member whatsoever. You guys have to deal with this every single day for the rest of your lives and in your dreams and in your nightmares. My God, I don't think I could go on if I was in their shoes. But they are not in charge of, they are not responsible for finding the real killer. They're responsible for trying to go on with their lives. They're responsible for trying to take care of their family members that are still with them. And that's where they should be. There are other people on the outside that do disagree with the assumption that Richard Allen is the killer and the conviction. And for good reason. And let's go through that a little bit more. Let's start from the beginning. February 13th of 2017, Abby and Libby, two best friends, were dropped off at the Monon High Bridge Trail for a little afternoon adventure. They never came back. The next day, their bodies were found in a wooded area near Deer Creek. No witnesses, no immediate suspects, just a single chilling piece of evidence. Libby's phone, which captured a short video of a man, later dubbed Bridge Guy, telling them to go down the hill. And I would very much hesitate on even saying he was telling them to go down the hill now that we have seen the entire Bridge Guy video. Because for years, all we had was that 4 to 5 second clip showing this man and him saying down the hill, which actually is not accurate to that video at all, which we have on our channel. Go back and look at it in its entirety. You can see how this video was edited by Delphi authorities to give you a little bit different of an impression of what was going on in that video. The girls, in fact, are the ones who talk about going down the hill first. The guy in passing just seems to kind of acknowledge that that's where they want to go. So there's that. The Bridge Guy video, I feel, has been debunked of its ominousness, if that's even a word. Could it be something? Could that man on the bridge have something to do with this? Sure. But in my opinion, there's nothing in that video that necessarily links that man to these murders. Other than he was out, just like many, many, many other people on the trail that day, going for a walk. Might he be involved? Yes. Is he? Just because he was on a video? Your guess is as good as mine, but it's a big assumption to make. For years, police chased leads, interviewed suspects, and released new sketches that only seemed to add to the confusion. The case stalled. The family suffered. The town held its breath, waiting for justice that never seemed to come. Then in 2022, the name Richard Allen resurfaced, and now here's where things get more messy. Allen wasn't some mysterious figure lurking in the shadows. His name had been right there in police files since 2017. In fact, he had already admitted to being on the trail the same day as Abby and Libby. Because right after they discovered these two little girls were dead, they asked the community who was out there. What did you see? And Richard Allen raised his hand and said, "Hey, I was out there. How can I help?" Back then, authorities said, "Thank you. Okay, be on your way." Then in 2022, they said, "Oh, this was a misfiled tip. Somebody going through documents went, I think this might be something. Don't really know how, what, or why." But she brought it back up, and then authorities jumped on it. again, don't really know why, other than the other suspects in the case were either dead or in prison for other crimes, or they deleted the videos of the interviews that they did with them. Oversights, right? Whatever you want to call it. His name slipped through the cracks. Wasn't taken seriously until years later. Probably never should have been taken seriously because he didn't really bring a whole lot to the table. When they finally arrested him, the public expected a mountain of damning evidence. DNA, surveillance footage, a smoking gun. And they didn't get any of it. But they sure told those families they had the goods. We got him, guys. We know your daughters are gone and we can never replace them. But look, we think we got the guy. Trust us. Instead, the prosecution leaned on three key things: a bullet, a video, and Richard Allen's own words. Words spoken after 14 months in solitary confinement, being tortured, locked away in conditions that could break even the toughest of people. Let's break it down. First, the bullet. Investigators found an unspent 40 caliber round near the crime scene. Common bullet. And according to some half-assed ballistics testing, the bullet matched a gun owned by Allen, meaning it could fit in a gun owned by Allen. And in reality, let's be clear here, probably a good chunk of the population in Delphi, Indiana. There was nothing super specific about the markings on this bullet that directly put it in his gun at any point in time. In fact, there was about 40 to 60 or more volunteers, investigators, officers who had guns wandering all over this area and then left. And then they found the bullet. They didn't find the bullet before all those people with guns trampled the property. The odds of one maybe dropping a bullet, probably a bit higher when you have that many people. But no, this one they found, it must belong to Richard Allen. Because it couldn't belong to any of them, right? Other people who had the same type of gun. Nobody went back and looked at any of that. They just said, it must be his. He has a gun like that. Okay. Not exactly an open and shut case, right? The defense raised serious doubts about the reliability of the ballistics analysis, and no one could explain how an unspent bullet, meaning it had not been fired, ended up at the scene. I know that nobody could explain it other than they just chose not to look at what we just said. The obvious. That's how you could explain it. And then there's that video, that bridge guy video. The infamous clip that we talked about, the grainy, low quality footage of a man walking along the bridge, followed by the now infamous audio down the hill. The state said the man was Richard Allen. But here's the issue. Nothing about the video proves it's him. It doesn't even look like Richard Allen. The guy in the video is taller than Richard Allen. The guy in the video is more heavier set than Richard Allen at the time. It looks like somebody, but it doesn't look like Richard Allen. Looks like one of their other early suspects, Ron Logan, actually, when we compare it. But hey, it's Richard Allen, because in 2022, when you've not arrested anyone and you've seemingly blundered a lot of your leads and you need to get somebody, let's just say it's him. The prosecution argued that his body shape and clothing were similar. Not really. But they argued it. You know, just like your kids argue with you when you point out something factual. They're like, no, I think it's this. No, you're wrong. You're wrong. There's fact and there's not fact. Fiction, some would call it. But with no facial identification and no clear timestamps, it's more assumption than hard evidence. But the biggest factor, the thing the families held onto the most, were Alan's confessions. And again, you want to believe that those who are there to protect and serve are actually doing that. And maybe they had the best of intentions and got really just blinders on. We don't know the answer to that. And this is where things take a big turn. While sitting in a prison cell, isolated from the outside world for 14 months. It's not like he was in there for a day or two. 14 months. 400 some days and nights, completely isolated. Being taunted by the guards, not being able to communicate with his attorneys effectively. Well, kind of makes you go mad at some point. Because keep in mind, this is a man who shouldn't be in prison, should not be in solitary confinement. He should be in the local jail. After 14 months of torture, he was willing to say anything. And reportedly confessed to multiple people, prison staff, fellow inmates, even his wife during phone calls. Anyone who would listen, really. But these confessions did not sound like Richard Alan. When he wrote them down, it didn't look like his writing. Because, to put it bluntly, he had lost his mind. He was confessing in writing that looked like it was something from Picture Page or Romper Room. Giant letters scrawled around a piece of paper in really weird writing. I mean, it looked like something of a kindergartner, really. And then, for good measure, I'm not trying to be crass here, but I'm trying to paint the reality picture here. He's eating his poop. He's running headfirst into walls. Does that sound like someone who you would take anything they say seriously? Let's think about all this for a second. He'd been locked up in conditions that his lawyers described as akin to a prisoner of war. And yes, that's still going on in our country because, you know, nobody really seems to want to do anything about it. Solitary confinement, no meaningful human interaction, his mind deteriorating. And when you put someone in a cage like that for that long, their grip on reality will slip. It would slip on you too. The prosecution, of course, called his confessions proof of guilt. But the defense painted a different picture, a man so psychologically broken that he didn't know what his real name was even anymore. A man willing to say anything. Because frankly, he wasn't in his right mind. That's not a hard one to understand, but for some it seems to be. I don't know why, but it is. But if you just look at that a little bit, ponder that, do a little research on what those conditions do to a brain. It's like putting a turkey in the oven on 500 degrees and leaving it in there for 14 months. Taking it out and going, well, I'm really surprised this thing is, I don't even see it anymore. It seems to be strictly just charred. There's just charred ruins of something in here. I can't even tell it's a turkey anymore. Why doesn't it taste like a turkey? Well, the turkey is saying it's a turkey. You cook somebody that long, their brain's not quite right anymore. And honestly, probably never will be, unfortunately. And that's where this case boils down to, was this about justice or was this about closure? Because here's the truth. The families believe Richard Allen is guilty, not because the evidence overwhelmingly proves it, but because they need him to be guilty. They need a resolution to the nightmare they've been living since 2017. And you can't blame them for that. No parent, no grandparent, no sibling should have to live with that kind of endless, unbearable grief. But does needing an answer mean we should settle for any answer? And settle for these investigators who seem to have missed so many obvious red flags or just pushed them away for whatever reason? No. No, it does not. What about Richard Allen's family, his wife, his daughter? Their lives have been shattered too. Because whether he's innocent or guilty, he's been stripped of everything. His home, his job, his future. If he's truly the wrong man, what justice exists for them? The trial, it came and went. The jury deliberated. The verdict came down. 130 years in prison. On the confessions that were coerced by torture, a bullet that really could have been anybody's, and the fact that he raised his hand and said, "How can I help? I was there that day." That's all it took. For Abby and Libby's families, it was a moment of relief, a long, agonizing chapter closed. But for Richard Allen, for the people who believe he's not the killer, the story is far from over. The state called it proof. The defense called it circumstantial. And the truth? Well, the truth depends on how closely you're paying attention. When Richard Allen was arrested, prosecutors needed something concrete to pin him to the murders. After all, you can't just walk into a court with a five-year-old tip and a hunch. So they zeroed in on that single unspent .40 caliber bullet found near the bodies of Abby Williams and Libby German. That bullet, according to forensic analysis, although not very good, had markings of a Sig Sauer P226, a gun owned by Allen. Never mind, again, that there were all these other people walking around there that probably also had the same weapon. At first glance, it sounds damning, a bullet from Allen's gun found at the crime scene. It's not a coincidence, right? It's physical evidence. It's something solid. Except, not really. Sounds great. You could convince people who really want to find a solution and an answer that this is something. But here's the problem. It wasn't a spent bullet. It had not been fired. It was just there lying on the ground. And if a bullet wasn't fired, then the only way it got there is if someone physically placed it at the scene. So that leads to two possibilities. Either Richard Allen was there, dropped a bullet, and then left without taking any other action, or someone else had access to his gun or a gun like it, or just a bullet like it, and dropped it. Which, again, could have been any of the 40 to 60 plus other people wandering around the crime scene, which they found the bullet after that. Ballistics experts test-fired Allen's gun and determined that the markings on the bullet matched, and then destroyed his gun. So no one can go back and look at it. What? Why did you do that? Well, we don't. That's what we do. We just destroy the weapon and say it's true. But ballistics isn't DNA. It isn't a fingerprint. It's an analysis of tool marks that relies heavily on interpretation. And in recent years, it's come under scrutiny for being far less definitive than people think. Even the National Academy of Sciences has raised serious concerns about its reliability in court. And let's not forget, it's not like investigators found a second bullet that had been fired and connected to a gun that was in Allen's hands that day. They found one unspent round on a gun he said he didn't even take with him. He's out for a walk. And the crime wasn't committed with a gun. It's committed with a box cutter. But it was enough to convince a jury. Then there was the video, the piece of evidence that everyone knew about long before Richard Allen's name ever made headlines, or at least the extremely edited version that Delphi authorities put out there. Why they didn't put the whole thing out there makes no sense. Why they edited the video and then put it out there makes no sense. And when you finally see the video in full, you go, oh, well, I get it why they did all that, because it doesn't look as grisly and damning as their edited version does. That doesn't go along with a narrative, though, now, does it? And when you need a narrative to work, you got to make it sizzle. You got to make it feel like it works. And if the real thing doesn't quite do it for you, well, then you edit it. But that's what you do when you're making a movie, not when you're trying to figure out who murdered two little girls in your town. But I guess in Delphi, it's what they do. The footage from Libby German's phone that they released was short, a few seconds. Just long enough to capture a man walking along the bridge, hands in his pockets, his gait steady, and looking a lot like Ron Logan, where the girls' bodies were found on his property. But hey, that's nothing. The quality was grainy, the resolution poor. He wasn't looking directly at the camera, and yet law enforcement insisted this was their guy. Without releasing the whole video to the public until after they convicted Richard Allen. In 2025, they released it in full. Now, let's be clear. Nobody disputes that the man in the video is the same man who spoke the now infamous words down the hill. That much is accepted as fact. The real question is whether that man is Richard Allen, and if the down the hill is really as ominous as they tried to make it feel. Because again, we've played the video many a times. I'm not going to play it again right now. The girls are the ones that are talking about going down the hill and looking for a path. And then this guy walks past them. Hey, guys. Down the hill? Kind of like, oh, they're looking for the path. Down the hill. There it is. Something probably almost any of us would do if we're walking past two looking confused girls on a trail trying to find a path. Yeah, it's down the hill. In 2017, investigators released two different sketches of potential suspects, years apart, that look nothing like Allen. And look nothing alike, either. Then they pulled those sketches back and said to ignore the first one. Why? Then they released an age progression on the second one. None of them look like Allen. The prosecution didn't even bother to bring up the sketches during trial. I wonder why that is. I wonder. There's the sketches. And the sketches, by the way, that we're showing on the screen right now on our YouTube channel over here, over there. They are half sketch, half real face. And the faces that they're matched with are not Richard Allen's. It's actually Keegan Klein and his dad. And my goodness, how shockingly accurate they seem to be when pushed together side by side. Nothing to see here. So, sketch is not brought up at trial. They relied on the idea that Allen lived in Delphi, owned a similar-looking jacket, and had allegedly confessed. The problem? That video clip is nowhere near high resolution or quality enough to definitively say it's him, or that jacket was even his. Sure looks a lot like the one Ron Logan wore a lot in other videos. And the walking, the gait, looks like Ron Logan. If you showed it to 10 random people with no context and asked them to match it to a photo lineup, you'd probably get 10 different answers. So why did it stick? Because people saw what they wanted to see. For 5 years, the footage was all anyone had to go on, that little clip. The public studied it obsessively. They stared at that blurry figure and tried to give him a face. By the time Allen was arrested, confirmation bias had already done its job. But the video and bullets were only half of the case. The other half, words. Richard Allen's confession. Not once, not twice, but over 60 times. You know, like you do. You confess 60 times to a crime. And that might sound like a slam dunk, but let's look at when and where those confessions actually happened. They weren't given freely in an interview room. They weren't written down and signed after a careful interrogation. Nope. They came after months and months and months of isolation, being tortured, locked in that cell that his lawyers described the conditions as medieval. Allen spent 14 months in solitary confinement at Westville Correctional Facility, 14 months where he was denied normal social interaction, 14 months where he reportedly began talking to himself, slipping further into a mental state that was anything but stable. And that's when the confession started. When he wasn't stable, eating poop and running headfirst into a wall. Some of the confessions were to inmates, some were to guards, some to his own wife over the phone. And when the prosecution got their hands on the recordings, they played them in court as proof of guilt. But let's think about this logically. If someone commits a crime, especially a brutal, high-profile murder, and keeps quiet about it for years, why would they suddenly start blurting it out in jail to everyone? That's not how guilty people behave, ever. That's how broken people behave. And they broke him. The defense argued that these confessions weren't admissions of guilt, but the ramblings of a man psychologically unraveling. Then they brought in experts to testify about the effects of prolonged solitary confinement, how it erodes a person's sense of reality, how it creates delusions, how the human brain simply isn't designed to function in that kind of isolation. Yeah, it's not. And if you think you could stand it, think again. The jury, they didn't care. They heard those words, Allen saying, "I did it." And that was enough. The question no one seemed to ask was, would Richard Allen have confessed if he hadn't been locked away under those conditions? If you watch his initial interviews, sounds nothing like the guy that's saying I did it 14 months after being tortured. Because that's the real issue. Were these confessions real, or were they a product of a mind that had been starved of everything a person needs to stay sane? The prosecution said it didn't matter that no innocent person confesses that many times. You know, the real big minds there in Delphi that seem to understand human psychology. But history says otherwise. Look at the Central Park Five. Look at Henry Lee Lucas. Look at Brendan Dassey. People do confess to crimes they didn't commit, especially when they're under immense pressure or when they've been placed in conditions designed to break them. That's why, like, the CIA and the FBI do not accept confessions that have been derived out of torture. But in Delphi, they do. And that's the crux of this case. Richard Allen's conviction wasn't built on DNA. It wasn't built on eyewitness testimony. It wasn't built on a confession given in a controlled setting with a lawyer present. It was built on a bullet that was never fired, a video that no one can prove is him, and words spoken by a man by, at that point, who was barely holding on to reality. And yet here we are. He's in prison. The families believe justice has been served. But for those still looking at the evidence, really looking at it, one thing is clear. Justice and truth are not always the same thing. There was one theory the defense wanted the jury to hear, one that would have flipped the case on its head, but they never got the chance. And it sounds a little wacky. Odinism. A word that before the trial, most people had probably never heard of. But in court, Richard Allen's attorneys argued that this obscure Nordic pagan belief system wasn't just connected to the Delphi murders. It might have been the key to the entire case. The theory was bold. Abby Williams and Libby German weren't killed by a lone man on a bridge. They were the victims of a ritual sacrifice carried out by a secretive extremist group of Odinists. The defense pointed to sticks and branches arranged around the bodies, supposedly placed in a way that carried ritualistic meaning. They claimed law enforcement ignored credible leads connecting known Odinist practitioners in the area to the murders. And if you think that sounds far-fetched, it wasn't just a shot in the dark. The defense claims they have names, actual people tied to this belief system who were investigated early on and then quietly dismissed. One of them, Brad Holder, allegedly had a personal connection to one of the girls. But despite the defense's efforts to introduce these details in court, Judge Francis Gall shut it down. The Odinism theory was ruled inadmissible. Why? Because according to the judge, there was no direct evidence linking these individuals to the crime. No DNA, no eyewitness testimony, nothing that could definitively prove their involvement. The court deemed it too speculative, too distracting. Just like that, the theory was buried. Except not on some of these guys' Facebook pages. Brad and some of his friends posting pictures that look mysteriously like the ruins. And two girls posed very similar to how those two girls were found dead. Again, nothing to see here. Raises another question. If there was even a chance that an organized group was involved, why wasn't that thread pulled harder? Who else was involved in this group? Maybe there's someone no one expects or we don't even know about yet in this case that really did not want this to come out. Maybe it didn't fit the state's narrative. Maybe once Richard Allen was arrested, there was no appetite for reopening other angles. Maybe law enforcement felt they already had their man and entertaining anything else would complicate the conviction. Whatever the reason, the Odinism theory was dead on arrival. But Odinists weren't the only ones whispered about in the shadows of this case. Before Richard Allen was ever a suspect, there were other names circulating, people who on paper seem far more likely to have committed these murders. Ron Logan is a name we've mentioned. Logan owned the property where Abby and Libby's bodies were found. The man lived just 1,400 feet from the crime scene. His alibi for that day, well, he made one up. He made one up before anyone even knew the girls were dead. He told his friend, "Tell everybody we went to the store." Why? Just do it. They found out it was a lie. Police searched his property looking for evidence that could tie him to the crime. And supposedly nothing stuck. We don't really know the answer to that question because the FBI raided his property eventually. And when they handed the authorities in Delphi all the information on a silver platter, they said, "FBI, you can go home. We got this." And then we never heard about what they found again. Logan died in 2020, long before Allen was arrested, but some still believe he knew more than he ever let on. Was he involved? Did he see something? Or was he just an old man in the wrong place at the wrong time? They dismissed him because they said, "He's too old." That was their reasoning. He's too old. Keep in mind, the man still handled livestock on a regular basis. So these two little girls, in theory, I guess just factually, wouldn't have been a big deal. Could have done it. The case against him never materialized, amazingly. And without hard evidence ever being exposed to the public, he remained a person of interest, but never a suspect. He ended up in prison for another offense, driving without a license, stemming from probation violations where he hit his girlfriend over the head with a wrench. Nice guy. Then there was Keegan Klein. A man, already facing charges for an entirely separate crime, became the focus of the investigation. Because of fake social media profiles, he operated under the name Anthony Schatz. That account had communicated with Libby German in the days leading up to the murders, even on the day of the murder. He was the last known person to communicate with her. And the evidence points to showing that they were supposed to meet there at the bridge. At least Anthony Schatz was supposed to. If Keegan showed up, you might want to run the other way. But nonetheless, people who were at the bridge that day and those sketches, they kind of resemble Keegan and his dad. Yeah, you tell me. Police had found Klein had searched for information about the Monon High Bridge the day before the girls were killed. No red flags here. And yet, despite all of this, Klein was never charged in connection with the murders. His involvement in the case remains one of those unanswered questions. One of those threads left dangling. Did he lure the girls there? Did he know who did it? Or was it just an eerie coincidence that he happened to be interacting with Libby right before her death? Or was somebody else using the Anthony Schatz account? One of the claims he's made in prison. You know, convenient. Hey, we narrowed down this catfishing account to you. You, the guy with hundreds of child porn pictures on your computer. Oh, you're telling us somebody else must have gotten your login? You've been hacked? Or you gave your password to somebody else? Yeah, we should just believe you. You know, take your word for it. They did. Talking to Libby right before her death, one of the last known people to have any communication with her. Nothing to see here. What makes all this worse is that in hindsight, the Delphi investigation was a mess. Tips were lost, suspects came and went, and key pieces of information weren't followed up on until years later, and many key pieces of evidence were just lost or simply disappeared. But remember, they went to the family and said, "We got this. We're going to get that killer." Many years later, after we failed over and over and over again, and if that failure gets exposed, we're going to look pretty bad. We got him. Well, it's been exposed. You set up this family to believe that you were right, or these families to believe that you were right. They believe you, and you failed them miserably. You pathetic pieces of, By the time Alan was arrested, there were already so many missed opportunities, it felt like authorities were desperate to tie the case up with a bow. And what about Alan's family? What happens to the people left behind when someone is convicted of a crime they likely did not commit? Alan's wife, Kathy Allen, stood by him for as long as she could, but after his arrest, her life unraveled. She lost her husband, their home, their entire sense of stability. Eventually, she left Delphi, unable to bear the weight of what had happened. His daughter, his only child, grew up with a father who worked a normal job, lived a normal life, never had a criminal record. Then overnight, he became the most hated man in Indiana. During the trial, Allen's sister and daughter testified on his behalf. They told the court about the man they knew, the man who had never shown any signs of violence, never given them a reason to believe he was capable of something this monstrous. But in the eyes of the law, it did not matter. Their voices weren't enough. Here's where it gets even darker. If Alan is innocent, if he really is just a scapegoat in a rush to close this case, then that means his family has lost everything for nothing. It means they've endured the worst kind of nightmare. Not only losing him, but being forced to watch as he wastes away in a cell. Wrongful convictions don't just ruin one life, they ripple outward, destroying families, destroying trust in the system, destroying faith in justice itself. And brutally violating the people who lost their loved ones to a crime by lying to them. By giving them false hope. And then doubling and tripling down on that false hope. And just keep saying, la, 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 la. We're right, we're right, we're right, we're right. Don't look over here. Don't look over there. Don't look that way. Don't look this way. Don't look up. Don't look down because we're right. Just keep it here. Keep it here. Anybody looks the other way, you might discover something that could blow your mind. And I can't imagine trying to handle that mentally as a parent of one of those little girls. So again, I don't blame them for feeling the way they do. Like I said earlier, they need to be there for their families and themselves and to try and keep moving forward. All of us over here will keep trying to find justice for the people who actually did, or the person who actually did kill your kids. Because the police and the court system in Delphi have failed you immensely. The problem with cases like this is that they force people to pick sides. Are you with the victim's family, seeking closure at any cost, or are you willing to question whether the system got it wrong? The media, they made that choice for the public long before the trial even started. From the moment Alan was arrested, the narrative was written. He was the man in the video. He was the guy who confessed. He was the monster. What they didn't talk about was the alternative suspects, the evidence that didn't add up, the details that raised more questions than answers, because that kind of coverage doesn't sell. The Bridge Guy video became one of the most analyzed clips on the internet. Amateur sleuths tried to match Alan's face to the blurry image. News outlets played the clip over and over, cementing into people's minds that this was the guy. The more they played it, the less room there was for doubt. Again, he doesn't even look like Richard Allen. But if you keep saying to people, that's him, that's him, that's him, that's him, eventually people believe things. It's called conditioning. And our minds are good at going down those roads, even when it's not real. When the confessions came out, it was over. Nobody cared about the conditions he was kept in. Nobody cared about whether he was broken or manipulated. They just heard him say, I did it, and that was enough. That's how the perception was. And in this case, public perception had already convicted Alan long before the jury did. So here we are. A man sentenced to 130 years, a town that thinks justice has been served, a family that has to live with the fallout, and a case that still has more questions than answers. Because if Alan isn't the killer, if there's even a chance that someone else is responsible, then that means one horrifying thing. The real murderer is still out there. Or he's dead. Which could also be a very real possibility. And there's another family destroyed beyond just Abby and Libby's. That's a tragedy. Thanks for watching. Leave your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. We'd love to hear them. If you're listening to us on the podcast channels, be sure to check out our YouTube channel as well, where you can interact with us and see all these cases in video. You can see the initial suspect sketches that we're showing here for you. You can watch the video of Down the Hill in its entirety, so you can see exactly what I'm talking about there. And check out all of our other deep dives into this horrific case of injustice. My name's Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. She was the perfect wife, always smiling, always supportive. A pillar of the community, beloved by friends, adored by family, and secretly researching undetectable poisons in her spare time. Maybe it was the way he chewed. Maybe she just got bored. Or maybe, just maybe, she had been planning this since the honeymoon. But if he had just paid attention, if he had just known what to look for, if he had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and learned the red flags, he could have heard every episode of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Ad-free, and before everyone else, he could have seen it coming. Instead, he's 6 feet under, and she's shopping for husband number two. Don't be like him. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.